evening, this evening shir is sponsored by Abe Mechi Zerika on the yard site of Abe's mother, whose yard site is this evening, which is Golda, Bas Reb Ezra, Azriel Zelig, Zichrona Livracha, and Zichrona Livracha. And thank you for sharing it with us. Tonight is the boy by Yom. We actually just learned across the hall for her memory as well, just between Mincha Maariv, which is why I just walked in now. Okay, so let's learn together. Just to put in context, those who are not here, just to put back into context. We're just at this point over here. We're doing a 3-part series right now, and this is the very beginning of Sefer Shmuel Beis. And the idea is the following: is David HaMelech hears news that Shaul HaMelech has been murdered in battle or killed himself in battle? It's unclear as to which narrative seems to be the predominant narrative. We'll get back to that next week, hopefully. And what happens is after killing the person who says he has perpetrated the crime, this is this Ger Amaleki. What ends up happening is the next thing is he eulogizes Shaul HaMelech. Which, before we even look at the text, we can just try to put ourselves into his shoes for one moment. Right? And just try to imagine how hard that must be. Meaning, this man has not only been a rejecting father-in-law, but has been a person who's really destroyed his whole life. You know, there could have been this symbiosis, there could have been this working together. Thank you so much, Orton. Thank you so much. We just said this is just actually a psukim for those who need it.
This is the actual, yeah.
These are actual psukim for whoever needs. Thank you so much, Autumn.
They're all the same. Yeah,
so, and by the way, at this moment, I just want to say how nice it is to see everybody back here. It really, really is. Special welcome to Ellen. Special mazel tov to Karen. Karen just come back from Israel and a wedding, and just entered into the next engagement. Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem. Hopefully on the side of the ocean. And show many, 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 many more smachas and good things to share together. So, putting ourselves back into his mindset, just to try to imagine yourself eulogizing Shaul HaMelech after your entire life has been fractured by running from him. Very, very difficult to imagine that. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to just look at the psukim themselves for a moment, take a step backwards, and there's so much in here. Let's try to unpack piece by piece, and there's very different ideas. Historical pieces, philosophical pieces, hashkafic pieces, Kabbalistic ideas, all embedded into this. This eulogy. So really, the eulogy isn't so long. It runs from Pasuk Yud Zayin all the way to the end of Pasuk Chof Zayin. So it's 11 psukim long. And I just want to just sort of cursory read over, just so we get that we have like the actual psukim, and then we can analyze it. While we're doing this, just sort of keep in the back of our mind the familiarity we have with these words, because these words should, some of them should light up some circuitry we have already. So here we go. So this is how it starts. Vayikonen David asakina hazois al Shaul va'al Yehonatan benois. So David says this kina. Now kina is like a word we use on Tisha B'Av, right? The kina, the way we generally translate it is lamentation, right? So it's a heartfelt expression of pain, of guilt, of remorse, of suffering. So David HaMelech says it on Shaul and Yonatan. Why is he not doing it on the rest of the people, by the way, just out of interest? There are a lot of other people killed. Shaul's other children were killed. Lots of Bnei Israel were killed. Why do you think he's focusing on these ones?
He was the Nasi. And
right, so we talk about the king and the crown prince. Right, so it seems to be the focus on the, we call it the apex of this enterprise. Vayomer lelamed Bnei Yehuda keshes, hinei kesuva al sefer yashar. To teach the children of Yehuda archery, this is written in the book of Yashar, the straight book. Confusing words, right? Yeah. Confusing words. Hatzvi Yisrael, tzvi, literally, usually translate as a deer or a rat or a hind. Albomasecha chalal. So apparently, Israel's like a hind on your bomasecha. On your slopes, chalal's empty. Eich naflu giborim. How did the strong ones fall? Meaning, it's almost like he's talking to the land and saying, "How did you allow the strong ones to fall on you? Where was they killed again? Just geographically speaking,
Gilboa.
It's called Gilboa. It wasn't just Gilboa. It's called
Har
Gilboa. It was a mountain. So when he's talking about bomosecha, right? So the slopes, we're talking about the imagery as a mountain. Al tagidu begat v'al tevasu bechutzot Ashkelon. Don't tell about this episode in Gat or in Ashkelon. Whose territory is Gat and Ashkelon in?
Plishtim.
This is Philistine territory. And Gat still is today, and Ashkelon is in Israeli territory today. But it's the coastal plain south where the Philistines live. Why? Don't widen until it there. Ki tismachna benos plishtim pen talozna benos arelim. Lest the women of the Philistines rejoice and make songs about the downfall of Shaul and Yonatan. So sort of like clamp down and don't release this news report. We'll have to see why that's such a something which grinds him so much. We're going to see the flip side in a second. Don't the mountains of Gilboa, don't let the rain and dew land on you. Kisham nigal mogen giborim mogen shaol, because there expressed the shield of the strong ones, sort of like absorbed, like pushed out. Bekli moshuach by beli moshuach b'shem, and it was no longer oiled with oil. What's oil got to do with shields? Yes, the way they used to do it militarily was they would oil their shields on the outside, so that when any like projectiles would be shot at them, they would slip off. So it sounds like it says that his shield was not oiled, so that his shield faltered, and that's why Shaul died. One quick second. Generally speaking, he says that Shaul and Yonatan were terrifying warriors. So Yonatan would never draw back his bow without hitting. Shaul's sword would never return empty-handed. Meaning to say, these are formidable warriors who were killed in this battle. Shaul and Yonatan ne'ahavim ba'ne'imim b'chayehem. Shaul and Yonatan, who are loved and pleasant in their life. Now remember, David HaMelech is saying this, right? Just imagine the amount of self-work, of self-control the person can have to do this. Lo nasaga uvamason nifrod, and in their death they did not depart. Minashorim kalu me'areos garaveru. From eagles they were lighter than eagles and stronger than lions. Benois Israel el Shaul Bechena. Now he turns to the daughters of Israel. So remember, don't let the daughters of the Philistines mock them. Let the daughters of Israel cry for him. Hamabishchem shani im adonim hamale adei zahav alvushchem. Who wear the beautiful silks, who dressed you in beautiful silks and put gold on your heads. Shaul was doing that. What exactly does that mean? I just really appreciate what that means. Shaul was the premier of the society, a society which was successful to the degree that people could live well. So you, who have succeeded in society, now cry for the person who allowed you to succeed. That's kind of the description he's giving. Eich noflu giborim, how did the strong fall? Besoich ha-milchama, in the battle, Yonatan albo masecha chalal. That Yonatan was killed on your slopes as a corpse. Tsarli alecha achi Yonatan, my brother Yonatan, I am in pain for you. By the way, it's actually his brother-in-law. Okay, but it's like a soul brother, so to speak. Naamtli ma'od, you are very good to me. Niflato avoschali me'avas nashim. Your love to me was greater than the love perhaps of his marriage. Now this is interesting. We have to think about what does he actually mean by this. We'll come back to that in a moment. And finally, he closes with a refrain: Eich naflu giborim v'yodu kle milchama. How did the strong ones fall, and the lost ones of and the implements of war were lost? And that's the ending. Now David Melech steps out of melancholy. He steps out of the realm of thought, and he returns to action. And that's the continuation of Shmuel Beis, as we'll see. Very, very interesting moment. There's a lot of complexity in this eulogy, as you can appreciate over here. First of all, I didn't have a chance to welcome my mother, who's joining us, to get a little bit of nachas on this side of the ocean. Baruch Hashem, I'm glad that it could work out. We could actually have a shir during a little bit of the time that my mother's here. So let's start and let's take a step backwards for me to appreciate what's going on over here. What seems to be the theme of this? If you're to identify a refrain, what's the refrain of this general episode, this general speech?
It repeats a few times.
Okay, good. So there's one phrase which is repeated three times, and that is the phrase Eich naflu giborim. How did they fall? Did the giborim fall? Now, Eich literally means how, right? But it's actually related to good. Another word which is Eicha. Right, and when we ask at the beginning, Eicha Yoshua Badad, how did the city stay alone? the city that was full of people, Jerusalem. The Mekonen there, Yirmiyahu, wasn't asking a technical question. Well, technically, they came from the south, and they put their war machine over there, and they used their cut off the river. He wasn't asking that. He was really asking, sort of in a sense, like, why? It's more of a why question. It's almost a rhetorical torturous question. That's similarly to what David HaMelech is doing over here, is this self-torture. How could it be? Why, Hashem, did you allow such people of strength to pass away? That seems to be the general overview structure, because that appears three times. It appears both in Pasuk Yod Tes, Yod Chof Hei, and Chof Zayin. Same exact words. Eich Naflu Giborim. Now, just a few basic questions, and that is, he says at the beginning, there's a very enigmatic sentence in Pasuk Yod Ches, where he says, you taught the children of Yehuda bows and archery, or bows and arrows, because it's written in the Sefer HaYashar. Generally speaking, Tanakh does not have a bibliography at the end, right? You don't get to the end and you're like, oh, where the end notes, you know, which publication was that from? So it sounds like the Tanakh is referencing another book. What other book is Tanakh referencing exactly? Here, over here. Meaning, Tanakh is saying something else. Go seek it out. Check out what the Sefer Yashar says about this. Another question is, before we get into into this particular point over here, is that what is this other book saying? What's the other book will be referencing? That it teaches the children of Yehuda war. But let's be clear over here. Which tribe is Shaul from?
Benjamin.
Which tribe is David from? Yehuda, right? So just to be clear over here, he's saying, teaching us from in the south, war, implements of war, and you can all find this out if you just do a quick periodical review in Sefer Yasha. So that's a very, very strange passage. What do you think? Shelley, you had a thought?
Yeah, well, there are books that weren't included in the Tanakh.
Good, okay, good. So on that note, there are suggestions. So take a look in Source 3 as an example. This is the Mikra Gesherix Encyclopedia. And many later academics say the similar idea, which is this is so if you're I apologize, I saw a different numbering over here in the source I gave you. Yeah, so it's actually source 12. I apologize. The reason why it's 12, even though it's really the third source, is because you're going over from last week, right? Okay, so that's why it is. So it's all connected. This is page 4 of 6, as you can see right now. Okay, so the Mikra Gesher Encyclopedia says Shem Shel Sefer Shira Atik Shavad. It's a book. It was. We don't really have it extant anymore. But nonetheless, if you were to look in there, there would be a reference over there. And v'nichtav v'alilos gvura v'shirei gvura shel b'nei Yisrael. And in it would be written all the, you know, strong songs about success of Israel. And it's mentioned twice in Tanakh. Oh, so where else is mentioned Tanakh? It happens to be Sefer Yehoshua is quoted elsewhere. So take a look. Reverse back to source 10. Sefer Yehoshua. Yehoshua, this is also an extremely enigmatic pasuk in Tanakh. Yehoshua is fighting against a coalition of the kings of Jerusalem and surrounding nations. And this is what happens in the middle. Source is Perek Yud Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayidom Hashemesh V'yarech Amod. Yehoshua is referring to what's just happened, where he caused the sun to stop, whatever that means. Right? There's a very, very big debate as to what exactly happened there. The sun stops, the Yorech stands, Ad Yikom Goy Ovav, until the nation avenges its enemies. That means Israel is able to catch up with all the people who it was pursuing. Halohi Kesuval Sefer HaYashar. Check it out. Look into Sefer HaYashar. Again, the same Sefer HaYashar. Vayamor HaShemesh B'chatzi Ayala HaYashamayim V'le'otz V'lavoy K'yom Tomim. And the sun did not go full, complete its revolution. Already, actually, the earth, technically speaking, doesn't revolve. While the day lasted. So again, Tanakh is referring to Sefer Yashar. The same debate ensues there. What exactly is going on? So what the more classic, more earlier Mepharshim say is, the only book that Tanakh would really refer to would be the Torah itself, right? Now we have to work out why it's called Sefer Yashar, right? Like let's call a spade, right? So why if that's true? But nonetheless, if that's true, we have two questions. One, number one is, where does it say this? And number two is why is it called Sefer Yashar? So this is what Rashi tells us in Source 11. This is in Sefer Yehoshua, the Rashi on that Sefer Yashar. He says, Halohi Kesuva, Dover ze niktava Torah, she'omar lo Yaakov li Yosef, zaroi shel Ephraim yiyeh melo agoyim. So he says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that the children of Ephraim, or the children of the Rachel side of the family, will be these very powerful nation. When is that Ephraim is going to reach this state of strength? When the Chama will stop for Yoshua, he's from the tribe of Ephraim. Nismale kol ha'olam shemoya shel Yoshua. Everybody knew about Yoshua at that point in time. So that means to say that the Torah has referenced the fact that there's going to be a mighty moment for Ephraim. Who does that? Yoshua halohi kesuv be'sefer ha'yashar. Back in Bereishis. Why would Bereishis be called Sefer HaYashar?
The others.
Okay, good. So it's interesting that we frequently call them Bereishis Shmos Vayikros Bamibar Dvarim. There happen to be different name codings for them. So, for instance, Rabbeinu Bachaye, the Netziv, the Ramban actually has a different name, but have different names for the different Svarim, and they call the first one Sefer HaYashar. The Ramban calls it Sefer I believe it's Bri'ah. No, Sefer Yetzirah is Bereishis. It's called Sefer Yashar. Why is it called Yashar? Yashar literally means straight. Why? Because it says in itself, in his introduction to Sefer Bereishis, because the Avos were people who found God, not because they were told to, but because they recognized in themselves. They arrived at straightness, they arrived at honesty because of self-made process. And so that's what's called Sefer Yashar. What does the Taf do? It refers us back to Sefer HaYashar, referring back to Bereishis. Fascinating. That's what Rashi suggests. That doesn't help us so much here, because if we think about that, in our case, what is being referenced in Sefer Yashar? The Lamed Livnei Yehuda Keshes. That the children of Yehuda need to know how to string their arrows. So where was that talked about? If we're going on the assumption that it's referring to Bereishis, then where in Bereishis is that being talked about? So in this particular instance, there's a very creative thought which is suggested by both the Metzudos and the Radak. So just to say, take a look at this. Let's see for the sake of time, which one we should do this. Let's take a look at the Radak for a brief moment. He says, Eich is in source 14. The Radak says, Eich hayazacher bekinas Shaul v'yonatan b'nei Yehuda shayu kenegen malchus Shaul. Why, pray tell, is David HaMelech eulogizing in his eulogy for the children of Shaul, who's from Binyamin? Why is he mentioning the children of David, of Yehuda? That's not who we're talking about. Aval Pirushoy, the explanation is, Vayomer lelamed b'nei Yehuda keshes, kodem she'achel lekonen aleihem. Before he starts the real eulogy, he says, don't worry, we know how to use the bow. Omala anashav, al tisyashu min atova. He says to his men, don't get worried that the king is gone. Va'al yarech levavchem b'mois ha'am Shaul v'yonatan. Don't worry that Shaul and Yonatan have been killed. Why? We still have strength. We still know how to fight, even though we aren't the king. We weren't anointed as the first kings. And where is that written? And that's referring to the Torah. Radukus Targum Yonatan Al Sifra De Oraisa. It refers to the Torah. Where does it say this? It says by Yehuda in the Bracha of Yaakov that your hand is on the back of the nape of the neck of your enemies, which means. Now don't worry, even though your Shaul is no longer in charge, don't worry, we will still succeed. So it's almost an internal reassurance, says the Radak, to the people around him from the fall of his Shaul. Which, by the way, also just sort of puts things in perspective. I know we think that David HaMelech was very strong and his band of 400 men was extremely powerful, but they also must have undergone some psychological stress, knowing that the leader had fallen and sort of like, the morale had dissipated. This is what David HaMelech is doing. So again, what the Radak is doing, he's saying it's referring to the Torah, it's an internal system, so it's not external, like Apocrypha as an example, but it's internal, but it's referring to a different aspect, which is an internal idea. And we're not going to read the Malbim inside, but the Malbim has a phenomenal and interesting suggestion. He says the following: there are two modes in which the nation of Israel can actually conquer the land of Israel. One is that Kadosh Baruch Hu says, destroy all the nations and I'll take it for you. Meaning to say, you do what you're supposed to, I'll be right behind you, I'll take care of it, the sun will stop, the walls will fall, right, or the stones will fall from the heaven, everything was going to happen, and that's what started happening. But as we saw when we went through Sefer Yoshua, things kind of petered out. You know, it started off very, very nicely, and then, everybody found there, well, this looks like a nice piece of real estate. You know, I wouldn't mind that tree in my backyard. Why don't we just stop over here? And so basically, although there are 31 kings that were conquered, there's a vast swaths of land that were left unconquered. So then modality two of conquest started. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, if you're not going to do it yourself, then, well, if you're not going to do it, I'm not going to lend myself miraculously to your your conquest, I'm going to make sure you're going to do it militarily. You're going to have to actually now train the army, have officers, get a robust, chariot force, and now you're going to have to do it yourselves. So that means to say that ultimately there's two choices as to how to conquer the land of Israel. Says the Malbim, and this is, by the way, he points out it's in Parashas Kisavah, where it says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if you're going to do it yourself, I will be with you. If not, you're going to have to fight yourselves. And he says, that's what's really happening over here. When it was with Yoshua, let's compare the two places where he mentions Sefer Yashar. When it came to Yoshua, that was a completely supernatural expression, right? The expression was that the sun's going to stand still, everything's going to happen, I'm going to take care of everything for you. Why? Because you're conquering the land like you should have. But should you decide to slow down, and should you decide that it's going to be more of a, we'll call it a slower process, then I'm going to leave it up to you, O human beings, and let's see how you do. So at this point in time, we're no longer in the miraculous conquest stage. So he says, now, l'lamed l'bnei Yehuda keshes. Now you need to be learning how to do it. So this next stage is being entered into. Why? Because of our own choosing. So in a certain sense, these are almost like bookends of each other. One is the supernatural, one is the natural, the very natural, which are both modalities of conquest of the lands of Israel, which are being expressed in these two references to Sefer Yashar, which refers back to the Torah, Parashas Kisavah. Very fascinating, fascinating insight. Although I'd like just to recap this because there's a little just the complexity over here. There were a few notions. It could be that he's referring to the Apocrypha, external book, so another book which was lost, which is not included in the canon Tanakh. Rashi said that it's referring to Sefer Bereishis, right, about the notion of Ephraim having strength. But this one over here seems to be either, as the Radak says, an internal sort of morale boosting that Bnei Yehuda can still do it, or the Malim says we've shifted directions as to how conquest is going to go from now on inwards, and it's going to be via armies and military. Which, by the way, should also be something which is worthwhile thinking about to us, is sometimes when you speak to people and you say, why isn't that you're not appreciative to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the state of Israel? So they say, well, the way Mashiach is going to come is Mashiach is going to come and, boom, everything's going to, all the nations are going to, be ejected miraculously. The Jews are going to all be brought back on eagle's wings. And that's it. And it's true that there are very enigmatic prophecies in Yeshayahu and Yechezkel about the end of days. But it should not be beyond our imagination that the Geula can happen in a military way as well. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows us with a lot of Siyata Dishmaya and a lot of miracles to be able to also set up an army which is going to be facilitating at least the first stages of this process. Just to think about this in terms in more common terms. David Melech says he says we've got to put up our socks and we've got to get going to do your word, Hashem. Anyways, let's go a little further into the eulogy. Just a few points to notice. So when we move to Pasuk Yotes, he said Atzvi Lecha Israel, the land is like a sort of like a deer. Or the word tzvi also means deer with the word D-E-A-R, not just D-E-E-R. Tzvi means something which is desired. You're so precious, O land, how could you let Shaul die on you? It's almost, where we see these kind of things? There's what we call a personification of the land of Israel, more than any other land. In examples, we see this elsewhere is, where do you see the land is personified around death? As an example, sometimes we see by Hevel, right? The land swallows up his blood. Later on, we see by Ari Miklat, we say that when a person is killed, whether purposefully or not purposefully by the other person, we talk about how the land lo yichupar b'adam shufach bo. The land isn't going to allow that to slide off it. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, or David HaMelech is saying to the land, is how could you absorb the blood of Shaul? I mean, how could you allow this to happen on you? It's like there's an atrocity which has happened to the land itself. Just a different dimension of thinking about this description. Mm-hmm. Fascinating, right? Now, just a side point over here. But now, in the main point over here, why is it that coming back to this land thing, but in Pasuk Chaf Aleph now, he talks about how the rain should not land on Har HaGilboa. Fascinating. Why? Why is the rain not landing on Har HaGilboa? He's like sort of almost talking to the heavens. Heavens don't rain. Land don't give dew to Har HaGilboa, to the Mount of Gilboa. So down on the mountain. So it's almost like sounds like a little bit like a punishment to that area. Meaning this is the area which witnessed such a terrible tragedy. Let the tragedy sink in, so to speak. I think one can also suggest elsewhere that what the Malbim also suggests over here is a very fascinating idea, and that is that when you see that Shaul HaMelech died, it is clear that a person of such stature could not die because of somebody misoiled his shield that morning. People of that nature don't just die. They die because, at this point in time, a leader of that magnitude ran out of zechuyos or had a debt he had to have paid. We just talked about the different debts he had to pay back. But meaning to say, he says, and therefore, people of this now of this spiritual magnitude, we can know there must have been something where the zechuyos were not protective enough, which means if the zechuyos are not protective enough for him, then for you, the land surrounding him, who says you're going to get rain? Meaning to say, let's look at this from the spiritual glasses rather than the physical glasses. Oh, how did he die? Spear, place, how, velocity, penetration. No. He says he died because there was not enough zechuyos protecting him. So the land, how do you think you're going to be sustained? Now, it takes a David HaMelech to be able to say this because we're not pointing any fingers, right? Just let's be clear about that. But nonetheless, what he's saying is it's perhaps an aura of what's going on around him, which is sort of rereading the way history works. Very spiritual idea, very hard idea to digest.
Does that mean that anybody of greatness, David, any of them that died, it couldn't just stun that they...
There's people who died their time and not at their time. David HaMelech died at his time. Uh-huh. David HaMelech died at 70 years. He was given 70 years, the Chazal tell us, from Adam HaRishon. Adam HaRishon lived 930 years. He loaned David HaMelech 70. It seems pretty clear that Shaul died before his time. That seems clear, and the reason why we know that is because Shmuel told him that. Right, so we had a Navi telling us that you're not supposed to, because of certain things you did, the only way to atone for it is such. And he knew going into this battle that he was going to die, as we saw, because if he ran from the battle, he would have borne his sin. If he went into battle knowing he was going to die, he would cleanse his sin enough to join Shmuel in Gan Eden. We saw that was Shmuel's conversation to him in Perek Lechav Tes, back in Shmuel. So this is an untimely death, and David HaMelech is saying, don't think that you can just kill somebody like that. That doesn't just happen. So land, don't think you just deserve rain. Don't think... That's what the David HaMelech's spiritual domain of yeah. I wonder just personally, later on when you read later writers like, for instance, Lahavdil, Shakespeare, there's a certain notion of what's called the natural order of things. So whenever you see a king dies, there's a shifting in the natural order. Right? So for instance, when you look at Julius Caesar, Hamlet's father, when you see Macbeth killing Duncan, all the kings who get killed. There's a lot of kings getting killed in Shakespeare, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really disturbing. But nonetheless, there's always something wrong that happens in nature around that. There's an example here in Macbeth, in Source 18. So there's a discussion between the old man and Roth. Roth, this is just after the death of Duncan. He says, "Ha, good father, thou seest the heavens as troubled with man's act, threatens his bloody stage. By the clock 'tis day, and yet dark night strangles the travelling lamp." What's he talking about?
It's an eclipse.
Mm-hmm. So he's saying, I don't understand, it's getting dark in the middle of the day. Why is it getting dark? At the time about the owls flying during the day in Hamlet. Ooh, there's a lot of very strange things that surround the king's death, and the way that sort of the very, well, called staid themes of Shakespeare is light and dark, order, disorder, right? Chaos. There's certain sort of themes which are all the way through, and I believe that he's taking it from certain biblical themes themselves. One is that David HaMelech is almost saying that the natural cycle of things has been interrupted here by Shaul's death, and he's saying that that's why the Horei Gilboa don't accept the rain, because the natural order has been shifted or fractured at this point in time, which is another way of looking at it, similar to what the Malbim is saying. Food for thought, yeah.
In Pasuk Chaf Aleph, where it talks about Magen Shaul B'li Mashiach B'Shemen,
yes.
Could it be also an allusion to the fact that Shaul was oiled?
That's a good, very good, very interesting idea. Yes, that's interesting. That's a very interesting idea. Meaning, it's true that shields are oiled, but Shaul, the way to anoint a king, was also the same word, Mashuach, which is the oil on his head. Mm-hmm. So he sort of lost that anointment. Mm-hmm. Liz, that was what you going to say?
No, not at all. The only problem or question I have is, okay, we all know about Shaul, like, what about Yonatan? Meaning, Yonatan did not have a sin that he needed to... Meaning, why did he have to die in battle? And why is it looped together with Shaul like this? Like, just this part of it, I guess, if you're saying that Shaul died early, then Yonatan died extra early. So
you're right.
It leaves you hanging on the Yonatan bit.
Very hard. Very hard. I don't have any answer which really, really explains that. It's very hard. It's very hard to understand. You can imagine also that extra pain that David HaMelech is experiencing now through this, about this whole experience. I don't fully understand. It seems that he's almost collectively part of Sha'ol, which is hard to understand. It sounds like he's collectively part of Sha'ol's experience. So yeah, almost as if paving the way for David with Sha'ol, Yonatan's death. Now remember, Sha'ol had said things like this to Yonatan. Sha'ol had warned Yonatan, if you support David, ultimately it's going to be your death. But it's just interesting thing. It's almost as if Yonatan took on the role as the facilitator of David coming in, even at his own self-negation to the point of death. That's what it sounds like. Which is almost like, and Sha'ol told him that. Sha'ol told him explicitly in Perek Chav. We saw with the Machar Chodesh episode. Very, very tragic moment here. But we did note as well that when we learned this last year, that the Minchas Shai points out that Yonatan's name is spelled two ways. One is absent of a hay, and one is with a hay. Okay. So if you know different boys who are called Yonatan or Yehonatan, they're both right, they're both the same name.
Yeah.
But the Minchas Shai points out that the meridian of change happened when Yehonatan sublimated himself to David. He became thereon inwards Yehonatan. It's almost like his mission in life became his bringing David up, even though it was to the point of self-negation. This is the greatest poem. So now he didn't commit suicide. But the point is that almost sort of in this way. Okay, so let's just focus on one or two other points and then to hold over here. So first of all, over here we see a very interesting notion about the afterlife. So David HaMelech said that you are beautiful, you are wonderful in your lives. Uvamoisam lo nifrodu, and your death did not part. That sounds like a famous, right? In death do not part, right?
Death do us part.
Good. So now, by the way, that is taken from this perek. Okay, and that's one of the phrases which is pulled from this perek in Tanakh. What does it mean that they did not depart in death? What do you think that means?
That their presence or their teachings were still...
Okay, so maybe it's something of the death. So before even getting there, some of the Mepharsh Apshat say a very simple thing.
They didn't die, they came back. Divided
because Mifrad means separate.
Oh, okay, so that's interesting. So maybe taking your point into account... What some of the Forshim say is that they didn't retreat in battle. Meaning to say, the troops on the battlefront, they were losing the battle, they didn't retreat, they didn't separate themselves from the rest of their cohort. Which is something to be said about their courageousness. They didn't die with their arrow in their back. Right? So they died on the battlefront. They didn't separate from their troops. But maybe it's even more than that. And that's what Rashi says is, they didn't separate from each other. Not necessarily the cohort of Israel around them, but they themselves, which is now symbolic of what you were just saying, meaning, although they really did exchange words, Yonatan defended David and was ejected by his father, and it was a complex relationship, but nonetheless, at death, they didn't part. Rather, somehow they managed, somehow, whether physically, emotionally, spiritually, they remained together with each other. Then coming back to autumns, another, the last dimension which the Malbim suggests over here on a spiritual level is this again is another time where Tanakh is busy telling us, yes, there is a hereafter. It's not party and be merry for tomorrow we die, and that's it. Right? No. They didn't disappear. They didn't sort of float off and disapparate into oblivion. There's a world after this. All their goodness and their ni'imus, which they had in this world, is going to continue into the next world. Don't be mistaken. That's what David HaMelech seems to be saying over here. So whether it be their acts at the point of death and lack of separation, or whether it be beyond death, this is another indicator of the notion of that Judaism doesn't view this as the be-all and end-all, and that actually translates into the way we live, not just the way we die, which David HaMelech is saying to us. And now, the most complex part of this parak, which is wildly misinterpreted, which is the last section over here in Pasuk Chavav, David's beautiful words for Yonatan. So he says, "You, Achi Yonatan, my brother, you na'amta li me'od, niflat, niflei aso, avoscha li me'avas noshim. Your love to me was greater than the love you would have, a romantic love in marriage." Now, so I did come across as an example of just an essay topic I came across just when researching this. David is super gay. Now, without skirting the issues of the Torah perspective of this way over here, let's just focus for a moment on the actual text, because over here we just need to be appreciative of what the text is telling us more than necessarily what we want the text to tell us. So just something which is interesting is that there is this notion, and the Torah, the Tanakh is very clear that there is a love between Yonatan and David. There's no question, and they talk about the love that they have. But the word love perhaps is the wrong translation of the word ahava, meaning to say, when we talk about the way that we use the word love today, it's used in certain contexts, which is can be understood in the form of union or intimacy. That's not necessarily the only meaning of the word ahava, right? Just to appreciate things. There are words that Tanakh uses for intimate relationships, right? They're not used in this context ever, right? So those words, and there's many words for it that the Tanakh uses for it, but it's not what's being used over here. Which as an example, so the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, as an example, here's the way it says in Pirkei, in source 22, Kol ahava shi teluya bedavar, any love which is dependent on an issue or on an idea, or botel adavar, botel ahava, if the relationship was based on something and then something goes away, then the relationship falls apart. If it's not dependent on any particular issue, it's never lost. What is love which is dependent on an issue? Zu avas Amnon v'Tamar. This is the love of Amnon and Tamar. Remember, he raped her, right? And then afterwards, he hated her. Why? Because what was his love dependent on?
His lust
for her, right? So when the lust disappeared to him, right, when he gave himself access against her will, then that disappeared to him, and so therefore she was simply the object of his own self-gratification, which, and therefore, that disappeared. There was no ahava left. However, v'she'eno tuluya b'davar, if it's not dependent on any issue, zu avas tuluya David v'yonatan. This is the love of David and Yehonatan. So what the Mishnah seems to be saying over here, and the Rambam says the most unfortunate say over here, is that in a certain sense over here, we're talking about a love which is this most sublime level of relationship. We're talking about the meeting of minds, the meeting of bodies. Right? Why is it that we have to sort of always put something into what will sell as an ad for 30 seconds in a Super Bowl ad? Like, it doesn't have to be like that. We can also talk about ideas. We can talk about of real friendship. What the Rambam talks about in three levels of friendship in Pirkei Avos, where we talk about something which is much more a platonic level of relationship, which is much more sublime than even a physical relationship. It is interesting to me that the relationship that the Mishnah gives of something which is Tuluya B'davar is, in fact, is a physical relationship. The example of a relationship which is not Tuluya B'davar is a relationship which does not have a physical component to it. Isn't that interesting? Because if it were to be simply an intimate relationship, then it would be the same as Amnon and Tamar, perhaps. Is that interesting? So, like, just to appreciate this in terms of that. Now, this is not about what the Torah's attitude is, but just in terms of the parshanut itself. There doesn't seem to be an indication that, as many have argued, that David and Yonatan were talking in the terms of intimacy, we'll call it, very progressively. But nonetheless, it is interesting to me that there is an additional level of interpretation which I think is worthwhile noticing. Here's an example of why we should never jump to conclusions, not even just in the Phantom Toll Booth, okay? Because why? So if we read this, it's actually interesting. So there's a book called Ben David LeShaul. I think it's in this library. It's a red book written by Rav Yoshua Bachrach. They're out of print. You can't find them anywhere. So if you're in Israel, you might be able to find one of them. Incredible, incredible books on Tanakh. Now, if you ever are able to get a hold of one, don't let it go, because you can sometimes get them on eBay. I managed to find one. I was walked through. I was actually with my mother and my wife in Geula 2 years ago, and I walked to Manny's, which is the huge bookstore. They don't have any, and then they told me to go to another one further north, and I went there. They didn't have it, and then I was walking by a store. You know, one of those bookstores in the Geula area where the only way to walk in is to walk in sideways, right? Because there's so many books by the entrance. So I asked him if he had one, and he went up a ladder, which of course was between the rows of books, only certain dimensions of people could get up this ladder into the top. And he brought down from the top of a bookshelf, there were two, which he blew the dust off of, and he got them for me. So I managed to get Machar Chodesh, which is the blue one on Perek Chaf of Sefer Shmuel Aleph. And there was another one, I don't remember which one it was. It might have been Beit David Shaul. So at the end of the Sefer, he has an essay. Now this essay, it happens to be 80 pages long, so it's a little bit of a long essay. So I'm not going to do it justice, but one of the things he does point out is that over here you've seen an incredible thing. And that is that we have two dominions over here. We have the dominion of Yehuda, and we have the dominion of Ephraim, or really Binyamin, really, the children of Rachel and the children of Leah coming together. Now it's interesting that they only... Bnei Yaakov, or Bnei Yisrael, the children of Yaakov, all these 12 people, very, very, very close, came very close to splitting up, to in a certain sense, disbanding. There were so many moments where they sold Yosef into slavery, he had power over them. When they came back, he could have killed them all right there, incarcerated them, and they never returned home, no postcards, nothing. It would have been the end of the whole experience. So, but what happened? How were they able to marshal the power of the Shiftei Yisrael? It was when they were able to overlook where they own their own wrongs or their own pain. As an example, when Rachel is able to overlook her own sense of self and is able to give the simanim to Leah. When Leah, I'm trying to remember the episode of Leah, when Leah prays that her seventh child should be a girl, not a boy, so that Rachel will still have two shvatim, when they are able to mimavater, they're able to give up on behalf of each other, that is when the true Shiftei Yisrael were arrived at. So says David, not Yonatan, coming back to Lynn's point. Think about the self-sacrifice of Yonatan. Yonatan was the crown prince. He could have said, David who? David what? I don't know who you're talking about, David. I'm sorry, I'm just busy preening myself for my inauguration ceremony. You know, I mean, Yonatan had every right to be able to say, I'm hanging on to this. I'm going to be walking down the red carpet, and this is where I'm going to be sitting, and they're going to make, you know, when I get married, it's going to be a royal wedding, and that's it. But ultimately, Yonatan sacrificed everything. So says David HaMelech. Yonatan, he says, Niflaso avascha li. Your love for me, your endearment to me, was greater me avas nashim, the love of women, meaning Rachel to Leah and Leah to Rachel. Meaning their sense of self-sacrifice to one another was so great that it allowed Israel to exist and not fracture. Well, that's exactly what you managed to achieve over here, Yonatan. Yeah. Because otherwise, we would have always been split. We would have never achieved a united monarchy at any point in time if it weren't for you, Yonatan. So again, like when we read the psukim, yeah, if we read the English translation, okay. But the point is, there's much more depth to plumb when it comes to things like this. Again, there's another 79 pages of the essay. There's a lot more background into this. But that's sort of one of the central themes of it. Last thing just to notice, and this is not a part of the shiur necessarily, but it is interesting. The words that in this kinnah should be somewhat familiar, because they appear in various things that we say. They appear in various we'll call it memorial prayers that we do. So an example is on the left, on the very bottom of page 6, is the Kel Mole Rachmim we say for people who have passed away. Listen to the description we say over here. We say, this particular part isn't this. I must apologize. This comes about the Tzorah Chaim that actually appears later on in another one of David HaMelech's prayers. The Tzorah Chaim, but it does appear on the right hand side in the Avarachim. The Avarachim we say on Shabbos before Ashrei, before we put back the Torah, and this is actually a prayer which is instituted 800 years ago, around the time of the Crusades. And so in northern France and in Germany, when the Crusaders would come through and murder without any accountability, the Jews there. The Jews instituted this prayer, which actually would only be said at the beginning during the 6 weeks between Pesach and Shavuos, because that was the time when the Crusades came. It was when the spring happened, the roads were, the mud had gone down, the horses could now trample through to Jerusalem, and this is when the Crusades came. So it started off for 6 weeks, now we do it all year round. And here it says, Avarachim Shochem Meromim, Barachamov Atzumim, we've got Barachim Achasidim, Ayishorim Atzumimim. Hashem, please remember with mercy those the pious, the straight, the tamim, the pure, Kehilai Sakoresh, those communities of sanctity, Shemasra Nashama Kudashas Hashem, who handed themselves over. We think about it over here around the same time as York, who committed suicide in the Jewish community in York because of the blood libel outside. This is around this time in the years 1200. Who are loved and pleasant in their lives. And in death they did not depart. That's exactly our pasuk. That's exactly where the text is being pulled from. Right, and then we say, of course, it's wrong to do the willing of the bidding of their master. Remember them, like the rest of the tzaddikei olam, referring to Shaul and Yonatan. So remember these communities, and then of course the end of it is, take vengeance for those people who were killed. Remember, we're not asking ourselves to do it; we're asking our Kodesh Baruch Hu to take a vengeance. But we're going to see a lot of memorial prayers are going to be drawn from this text itself, because ultimately this is one of the first memorial prayers we actually have in Tanakh. So it serves as that framework. Meantime, we'll stop here. Last week will be next week, and the plan is going forward is to do a comparison. Lynn was very kind to actually send me in the direction of a very fascinating topic, which is the two deaths of Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech is described to have died two different times in Tanakh in two different ways. We need to sort of put those together from various different standpoints. Looking forward. Thank you.